If you know me at all, you know that I'm fond of history. I like to study history. As an American, you study American history, you know, and I was particularly drawn to the Revolutionary period. Apparently, we had some small disagreement with the British that we sorted out over a period of time twice. But I love that. That's one of my favorite parts. But now coming to England, living in England now, of course, you know, there's a whole new area of history I get to study and vastly more of it. You know, a good 1,000 years just since Hastings. I mean, this is awesome. So if you know me, you know that I like history. If you've had the misfortune of asking me a historical question and heard me bang on for the next 20 minutes about it, you get the idea. One of the things that I like to read, and I really enjoy reading biographies. I like to read about the people who made history happen. I was recently gifted a book from Janet and Trevor on William Wilberforce, and I finished that earlier in the year, and it was just great. I mean, learn about this guy who was such an important figure in early 19th century British history, and showed us that people can serve in Parliament and actually do good things. That's kind of a nice change. One of the things I don't really like is autobiographies, people who write their own life story. Some do a better job than others, but of course you always get the sort of, always run the risk of the bias that someone is, you know, painting a rosier picture of themselves than would normally be the case. And we see some interesting characters as we work our way through Genesis. We're going to see one in particular today. Unfortunately, Moses writes this account, you know, inspired by the Lord to write this without error and faithfully some hundreds of years after it all takes place. And we'll be looking at this at Genesis 31 today. We're going to go through the whole chapter. It's quite a long chapter, so bear with me on that. But we're going to notice a couple things in Genesis 31. We're going to have a look at how we would like to see ourselves versus the reality of our fallen nature. And we'll also see that our fallen nature need not be the defining aspect of who we are, depending on whose we are. And we will further consider that this requires honesty and patience on our part, as this is the Lord's work in us. So join me, if you will, if I can find it myself, in chapter 31. Oh, I had it. Now I botched it. In verse 1. Now Jacob heard that the sons of Laban were saying, Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from what was our father's he has gained all his wealth. And Jacob saw that Laban did not regard him with favor as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you. Lord, we ask that you give us the clarity and the of mind that we can read these words, read this story today, this important story. Every word, every single syllable is important. And we ask that we could see this today and understand that the message that you have for us to learn and draw a bit closer to you today, Lord. We thank you for this opportunity, and we thank you for the gift of your Son. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So, it's been a little while since we've been in Genesis, but as we get back to it, remember the last 6 years have been rather profitable for Jacob, but not so much for Laban and his sons. Remember, 6 years prior to this, Jacob had asked to be released from Laban's service after the birth of his son, Joseph. And now Laban, fearing the loss of his virtually free labor, and quite good labor at that, negotiates an arrangement to keep Jacob's services, an arrangement for which Laban immediately reneged and attempted to remove all the animals that would have gone to Jacob in this arrangement. Now, two things that Laban had not counted on was the Lord's provision for Jacob and Jacob's likely God-given skill as a shepherd, which ultimately reversed Laban's scheme and made Jacob the more prosperous of the two. So much so that Laban's sons have taken notice of this, and they're none too keen about it. They feel that Jacob has prospered at the expense of their potential inheritance. In fact, they think that Jacob is taking what is rightfully theirs. And this grumbling amongst them has come to Jacob's attention as well. They feel that Jacob would have nothing at all if it wasn't for Laban, and this is at least partially true, but just not in the way they see it. See, they likely have no idea that this is the Lord's work in all this, working favorably for Jacob and against Laban for his attempts to cheat Jacob and keep him indefinitely reliant. As Laban has noticed this as well, the relationship with Jacob has soured quite significantly. In truth, the situation we have here is precisely the opposite of what Laban had intended. Rather than keeping Jacob dependent upon Laban and indefinitely in his service, the tables have turned now to the point where Laban needs Jacob much more than the other way around. Laban seems to know not how, or more importantly, why this has come to pass, but Jacob is beginning to work it out. And it's at this point the Lord again speaks to Jacob, telling him it's time to go home. It's time to return to Canaan. That after 20 years' service to Laban, far longer than anyone anticipated, it is in fact time to go home, to return to his father Isaac in Canaan, both to receive his father's inheritance and to face Esau. Again, the Lord reminds Jacob, as he did in his journey to Paddan Aram, that the Lord will be with him. Join me as we read, beginning in verse 4. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah into the field where his flock was, and said to them, "I see that your father does not regard me with favor as he did before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength. Yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times, but God did not permit him to harm me. If he said, 'The spotted shall be your wages,' then all the flock bore spotted. And if he said, 'The striped shall be your wages,' then all the flock bore striped. Thus God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. In the breeding season of the flock, I lifted my eyes and saw in a dream that the goats that mated with the flock were striped, spotted, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in a dream, 'Jacob,' and I said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Lift up your eyes and see, all the goats that mate with the flock are striped, spotted, and mottled, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise, go out from this land and return to the land of your kindred.' Then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, 'Is there any portion or inheritance left to us in our father's house? Are we not regarded by him as foreigners? For he has sold us, and he's indeed devoured our money. All the wealth that God has taken away from our father belongs to us and our children. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do.'" So Jacob believes that it's time for him to go, and the Lord has confirmed this. He has all the assurance that he needs. But what about his wives? What about Leah and Rachel? What do they think of all this? Now, he's come here for a wife. He's gained 2, 4 if you count concubines, and he has amassed no small amount of wealth. But it's all for nothing if he leaves here empty-handed, 20 years potentially wasted. And so he brings Leah and Rachel out to a field to be certain that he can have a conversation with them in private. And Jacob begins to plead his case with his wives. Why it is time for all of them to go. Apparently Jacob is not quite certain whether Leah and Rachel's loyalties lie with him or with their father. So he gathers them to discuss the situation and the deteriorating nature of the relationship with Laban. Jacob tells his wives that their father no longer regards him with the favor that he once did. Now we must remember that was always born of what Laban could get out of Jacob. What we do not know is whether Leah and Rachel are aware of this on any level. And Jacob speaks to his wives regarding the Lord's provision for him all these many years. And this is something we have not seen in any real measure from Jacob in the past. Really, for the very first time, Jacob is acknowledging the Lord's hand in his life publicly. And the Lord promised to be with Jacob 20 years ago, and that has made all the difference. Jacob details how this has all come to pass as he elaborates in Laban's mistreatment of him, how Laban has changed his wages, has consistently altered their arrangement over the last 2 decades. And yet, no matter how Laban tried to cheat him, the Lord always acted on Jacob's behalf. He notes the situation with the flocks that Laban attempted to manipulate beginning 6 years ago, that no matter what his father-in-law did, the Lord provided animals that were appropriately colored. Colored in such a manner that they would clearly belong to Jacob in accordance with the agreement that Jacob, at least, was trying to uphold. And there's an interesting admission here on Jacob's part. He now realizes who was making all this happen. It had nothing to do with the peeled sticks that he laid before the animals as they bred. It had nothing at all to do with these superstitious efforts, and everything to do with the Lord being with Jacob as he had promised. We wonder if perhaps Leah and Rachel at this moment are wondering if the same holds true for the mandrakes that they once had such faith in. With this, Jacob tells his wives that the same Lord has directed him to return to Canaan. Now, as we realize now that none of this has escaped Leah and Rachel, they've also worked out this changing situation, and that they, like their brothers, have worked out that there's no inheritance left for them. And also that as Jacob's wives, they too face disapproval coming from Laban and his sons, their brothers. They realize that they've effectively been sold. They're being little more than the bait to lure Jacob into what is effectively indentured servitude. And there's been, in fact, a real transfer of wealth and prosperity from Laban to Jacob. With this, they pledge their loyalty to Jacob and commit to follow him in whatever the Lord has told him to do. Join me in verse 17, if you will. So Jacob arose and set his sons and his wives on camels. He drove away all his livestock and all the property that he had gained, the livestock in his possession that he had acquired in Paddan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household gods. And Jacob tricked Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he intended to flee. He fled with all that he had and arose and crossed the Euphrates and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him for 7 days and followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. But God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, "Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad." And Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen pitched tents in the hill country of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done that you have tricked me and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and trick me and did not tell me that I might have sent you away with mirth and songs, with tambourine and with lyre? And why did you not permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell? Now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to harm you, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad.' And now you have gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?" Jacob answered and said to Laban, "Because I was afraid, for I thought you would take your daughters from me by force. Anyone with whom you find your gods shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what I have that is yours, and take it." Now Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. So Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two female servants, but he did not find them. And he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat upon them. Laban felt all about the tent, but he did not find them. And she said to her father, "Let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me." So he searched, but did not find the household gods. So whilst taking Whilst the sheep shearing is taking place, Jacob sees an opportunity to slip away from Jacob. And we're not told why Jacob thought that he had to resort to stealing away in this manner. We rather hope that he would have trusted in the Lord such that he would realize this wasn't necessary. Still, we can forgive him to some degree for really not knowing how Laban was going to react. And Moses drops a bit of interesting information right here that Rachel stole Laban's household gods. And this is added with no further explanation other than to set up a later confrontation between Jacob and Laban. But we do learn a thing or two from this. One is that Laban is almost certainly not a follower of the creator gods, greater God, as he has these gods, these idols, if you will. And second, that Rachel believes these idols have some sort of value. Now, whether that's theological or purely financial value, we don't know. They were very likely small gods made out of some sort of precious metal, as was commonly done for thousands of years. But that is all quite unclear. Once Laban has learned all of this, that Jacob is gone, he sets out in pursuit of Jacob and company. And eventually, he catches up with the lot and asks Jacob, "What have you done?" By the way, this is the exact same question that Jacob once asked Laban some 13 years earlier when he found out that he had married Leah and not Rachel. Laban's exchange with Jacob is worthy of note in terms of the pure nonsense that Laban spouts here. And it's somewhat entertaining, actually. He's concerned that Jacob did not give him the opportunity to give them a proper send-off. He was not afforded the chance to say his final goodbyes to his daughter. And we get a rather straightforward sense that no one was believing any of this, and most certainly not the Lord, who for the night before told Laban in a dream that he was not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. It seems that Laban's inability to deal with the truth on any level was so pronounced that it was best that he said nothing. It's a shame the Lord doesn't talk to members of parliament in this way more often, but that's another matter. It's worth noting that Laban only refers to Leah and Rachel as his daughters in the exchange, not Jacob's wives. Laban then accuses Jacob of wrongdoing in that matter, saying that he's acted quite foolishly, such that Laban believes it is in his right and power to do them harm. Now, whether or not Laban actually believes this or is just bluffing to make himself look better is unclear at this point. And he adds only that he was prevented from harming Jacob because of a dream from the Lord. It's a bit like when you're on the playground and you were 5 or 6 and the bully was confronting you with something that he or she wanted and looked over their shoulder and said, "You're lucky because the teacher's here. I'll get with you later." Perhaps Laban is seeing this as getting him nowhere. It's then he asked why Jacob has stolen the household goods. And again, these are best seen as some sort of idols, likely small enough to carry away and hide easily, as we see. Now, Laban believes that Jacob has taken them, and this sets up the situation we have here, that yes, they were taken, but not by Jacob. And Jacob has had quite enough of Laban. And Jacob goes on the offensive here, answering the two questions that have been asked of him. He slipped away, as he did, for the very real concern that there would not have been this goodbye celebration, that there would have been nothing of the sort, and most likely yet another dodgy scheme to keep Jacob with him at best. And as for the household goods, Jacob rather indignantly challenges Laban to search for them, going so far to say that with whomever he finds them, they shall be put to death, not realizing that his beloved Rachel has in fact taken them. Laban did search everyone in Jacob's party, starting with Jacob, assuming he was the guilty party. And finding nothing, he eventually gets to Rachel's tent, where she has hidden them in or under the camel's saddle. And she claims that she cannot rise because it's her time of the month, as it were. Now, we're not told if this claim is true or not. If it is, Moses uses this to say something about these idols. He says, he adds a bit of cheek here. Not only that they can simply be hidden, They're of such inconsequence, they can be stuffed away somewhere. But they also, they're defiled by this ceremonially unclean woman. I think that's kind of funny. Join me in verse 36, if you will. Then Jacob became angry and berated Laban. Jacob said to Laban, "What is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? For you have felt through all my goods. What have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen that they may decide between us two. These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, and I have not eaten the rams of your flocks. What was torn by wild beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. From my hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was. By day the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I have been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side, surely you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night." So as Laban fails to find the idols, Jacob unleashes 20 years of frustration upon his father-in-law, uncle father-in-law. I'm not sure how that works out. Demanding that Laban tell him, what is it that he has done? That he's to be pursued as a common criminal. That he be thought guilty of theft and searched in such a manner. How he was treated as anything but family. He invites those standing around to judge between the two of them, who is in the right and who is in the wrong. And Jacob lays out his case against Laban, and he's got a lot to say about the last 20 years. He reminds He reminds Laban that his livestock have not miscarried. He's not taken any of them for food. If one was lost due to a predator, Jacob absorbed that loss himself. He endured the heat of summer, the cold of winter, and countless sleepless nights, all for the service of the man who gave him his wives. He may not be bringing any of this up until now before Laban. And for all his troubles, Laban has changed the conditions of their arrangement numerous times. And most of all, had it not been for the protection of the Lord, he would likely be empty-handed right now. This is why the Lord came to Laban in a dream the night before and rebuked him. Join me in verse 43. Then Laban answered and said to Jacob, "These daughters are my daughters. The children are my children. The flocks are my flocks. And all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day for these my daughters and for their children? Whom have they borne? Come now, let us make a covenant between you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, "Gather stones." And they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Laban called it Jagar Shadadutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me today." Therefore he named it Galeed and Mitzpah, for he said, "The Lord watch between you and me when we are out of one another's sight. If you oppress my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no one is with us, see, God is witness between you and me." Then Jacob said to Laban, "See this heap and pillar." I'm sorry, Laban said to Jacob, "See this heap and pillar which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that I shall not pass over this heap to you, and you shall not pass over this heap and this pillar to me to do harm. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us." So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. And Jacob offered a sacrifice in the hill country and called his kinsmen to eat bread, and they ate bread and spent the night in the hill country. Early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his grandchildren and his daughters and blessed them. And Laban departed and returned home. So Laban knows he has no answers to Jacob's claims. And the assembled crowd by now probably knows it as well. But still, he tries to save face, face, here, I'll get it, in the midst of all this. And he makes some rather bold claims. Laban tries, futilely, I think, to maintain a position of superiority that frankly everyone can see that he has lost. And he claims that these are his daughters and his children, his livestock, everything here somehow is his. You can almost hear the crowd snickering at this outrageous claim. Still, Laban attempts to use this as the basis for establishing a pact between the two parties, as though he is somehow an equal partner in this. And whilst it's clear to everyone that this is gaslighting on Laban's part, Jacob humors him. And so the two parties construct a monument to serve as a reminder of this agreement, a pillar and a heap of stones, each party naming it in accordance with their diverging language traditions. And we will see over time that although there is a family tie between the two, that the Arameans and the Israelites will tend to drift further and further apart in the years and centuries to come. Laban now hopes to invoke the Lord in guaranteeing that neither party crosses this point to harm the other. Jacob agrees and swears by the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the fear of Isaac. That's another way of speaking about the Lord. Some of your translations may say the dread of Isaac. This is in terms of reverent fear. And they conclude the covenant by sharing a meal. And the next morning, they depart and go their own ways. And Laban does say his final goodbyes to his daughters and his grandchildren, possibly never to see them again. And with this, we leave Laban to history, as we will not hear from him again. We read through these stories and we see these fellows like Jacob and his grandfather Abraham, and we see their life change, and as it improves only when they accept the truth of God and the truth of the Lord. It really starts to take real action and real direction when they surrender themselves to be used by the Lord, as Jacob is really just on the cusp of doing now. And I wonder if we've ever worried about what the Lord desires to do through us, what he desires to do through our lives. If you're a follower of Christ, you know where you once were before faith in Christ, enslaved to your sin and ever under its unbearable weight, and of course facing a far worse eternity. And you know how far Jesus has brought you from that point to this, the things that he has done in your life. Perhaps you've even been blessed to see Jesus work through your life for his plan and his purpose. But what about what is still to come? What about the things that he still desires to do through us? Or do we think, perhaps hope, that this is as far as it will go? Do we live our lives as though this is as far as it will go? Some of us, either because we can't imagine anything more that he could do for us, that he could do through us, or perhaps we hope that he wouldn't ask anything more of us than we prefer to do. But both are wrong. Both are even sinful ideas that deny Jesus' power and his sovereignty in our lives. So the question remains, where will this life and faith in Jesus Christ take us? More appropriately, just what does Jesus ultimately desire to do through our surrendered lives? And we find, much as we find Jacob at this point, we really can't know the full extent of that. And that's okay. Jacob didn't know here either. This is not the first time we've followed someone along their journey of faith. We saw a similar story with Abraham. And it was a journey that was punctuated by moments when they didn't look all that faithful. Here Jacob is in the middle of that journey. He's not the Jacob that he once was, but he's still not the Israel that he will become. But he is realizing the Lord's hand upon his life more than he ever has. Realizing that which he was promised 20 years ago is a promise that has never changed. And he has seen the consistency of that promise over 20 years that has endured all of the mistakes that he has engaged in, all the hardships that he has had, all of Laban's shenanigans. Jacob is now accepting the Lord's provision for him and reminding others of it as well. And yet there remains a bit of the old Jacob in him. We see this in how he responds to the Lord's instructions. The Lord told Jacob to return to Isaac, to return to Canaan. And Jacob had a choice to make. He could either relay this very same message to Laban and be on his way, regardless of Laban's reaction, or he could fear Laban more than he feared the Lord and steal away when Laban wasn't looking. Jacob's choice did not escape the Lord, did not escape us today. And yes, Jacob could have done better here. Imagine the display of faith that would have been. Laban, I'm going. See ya. To stand before Laban boldly in the Lord's strength and convey the word of the Lord, to convey these instructions. We wish that Jacob would have done that. We hope that we would do things like that in a similar situation. But then that's the thing, isn't it? We either have, I guarantee will be, in similar situations. If you've been a follower of Christ for any length of time, he has put you in positions to follow him. He has put you in positions to proclaim him. And maybe you've embraced those opportunities and maybe you didn't. And if even if you did, maybe it wasn't brilliant. And if you did not, you didn't feel very good about it. Either way, we find that we are somewhere along the journey just as Jacob is. And here we must deal with an important truth regarding our faith journeys, that no matter whether we do well or poorly, the promise never changes. The promise given in the garden to crush the serpent's head never changes. The promise that the Lord will defeat sin and evil through the sacrificial life of his Son, Jesus Christ, that those who accept his death in our place will have freedom from sin now and forever. And they will be reclaimed both in this life and when he returns for those who are his. The promise has never changed. Imperfect humans will never defeat a perfect God. Now we could hear this. Maybe we could think, oh, right, I guess I'm off the hook. Doesn't really matter how I live, what I do or don't do. If the promise continues either way. If you like a fancy churchy word, that's called antinomianism. I know you'd like that one. Until we remember that the promise is both for us and through us. Paul tells us many times that to take this position that it doesn't matter what we do, somebody even say, I can even go on sinning because I'm saved. Paul tells us many times that to take this position is to deny the promise. It's a very dangerous thing. It's a very strong indicator that we have not fully accepted the promise. This is the reason we have so many examples in the Bible of extraordinary things being done through ordinary people that all eventually realized the Lord was using them in some way to bring the promise to the world. And they realized that before they got to the end of their lives, quite a blessing really, before the Lord was done with them, realizing the blessing that they enjoyed to surrender their whole life to be used by him. And even then, they made some mistakes along the way. This is the grace and the mercy that we have only in Jesus. And even as we're getting it, sometimes we don't quite get it. And that's true. We all know that. But what does that say about us? And what does that say about Jesus? It says that we commit our lives in a pursuit to grow closer to him. We call that sanctification. It says that we learn something from the times that we weren't brilliant as followers of Christ, when we've made a proper mess of it. It says that he loves us more than our shortcomings, of which he is all too aware. Loves us enough to teach him something about himself so that he can work through us, and helps us to understand that we are blessed to be used to move the promise forward. Okay, Ryan, that's great, but what do we do with that? What does that mean to us? Well, perhaps we should start with a question this morning. It's kind of a giveaway question. Is the promise moving forward today? Will the promise move forward tomorrow? The promise that he will continue to defeat sin and evil in our lives and ultimately defeat it forever. I hope by now the obvious answer is yes. So let's move on to the next question. Will the promise move forward tomorrow? Again, I hope the obvious answer is yes, at least for our part of it, that we will be used by him, that we desire that he works through us, and at the same time that he is drawing us closer to him. But what about the promise when we run up against the likes of Laban, or even worse? Not if, but when. Let's be honest, it's hard to see Christ at work through us when there's a Laban right in front of us. Especially when it appears that Laban or that obstacle has the upper hand, when the scheming seems to be working. It could be even harder to be the one through whom Jesus is working when confronted with such a thing. This has and will happen to all of us. And we won't always handle it brilliantly. But it's easier the closer we are to Jesus, the better we know, surrender, and trust in him. But let's be rid right now, from here on, be rid of any notions that being a committed follower of Christ is an easy go of it. Above all things, we must remember that Jesus did not save us simply for our own sakes. He did much more than that. So that we can be the means to bring the promise to others, at least a means, so that others can live free from the bondage of sin, of our sinful nature, just as we do. We know that we are his, and he is working through us when we surrender our lives to him. When we are willing to go to the places and the people we would otherwise not, to proclaim his glory and his goodness and his gift to us. Some of whom could be in the room right now. Some of whom you will likely meet in during this week. That maybe they've realized that they don't have this promise. They've had quite enough of sin, quite enough of the destruction in your life. They're hoping that the promise of freedom is given for you. If it happens to be anyone in the room, you've come to the right place this morning, not to the church, not to this building, not to me, but the place in your life when you realize you can't sort this on your own. You've tried everything and been told that it will bring you peace and contentment, but none of it's worked. And frankly, there's nothing left but this promise that I keep banging on about. Jacob is in a similar place in his journey, and he will find his answers only in the Lord. Only now that he is returning to the Lord do the things begin to make sense. And can he be free from his sin nature?